thank you so much for taking time to sit down with for an interview with me today. And I guess the first thing I'd like to ask you is why did you decide to run?
Actually, I don't know if most candidates can answer that question with a moment in time answer, but for me, there was a moment a year ago, September, where I had a fundraiser in Carroll, and I invited former Governor Robert Ray, former Governor Terry Branstad to come as my guests, and we did this program called 30 Years of Wisdom, and the two governors reflected on their combined 30 years of service to Iowa. And out of that program that evening, a writer or reporter for the Carroll Daily Times Herald newspaper interviewed the two former governors, and an article appeared where both of the gentlemen suggested that Rod Roberts was the kind of Republican who should be considered in the potential field of candidates in the 2010 gubernatorial campaign. And so as that article went online and got circulated statewide, there were people who picked up on it, particularly in Eastern Iowa, and then some of my colleagues in the Republican caucus in the House did. And so they began talking to me, are you serious about that? Is that something you're thinking about? And, you know, most legislators, especially having now been elected, reelected to a fifth term, you've got some experience behind you. And there are people with time who look at legislators and conclude maybe that individual has what it takes to go on to another level of elective office, you know. And so they seriously said, you know, I ought to think about doing that. And really, a lot of my colleagues in the House Republican Caucus encouraged me to do this, even some of the members of the Senate Republican Caucus who know me well. And I guess that was really the catalyst, I would say, is that event a year ago, September, that article and the conversation it helped generate. Mm-hmm. And then other people encouraged me to do that from the standpoint of you obviously have been successful in running in a legislative district that historically is not known for electing Republicans.
Okay, I didn't realize that. Yeah. Carroll was more of a blue.
Actually, the way they've described it, and I have to say it in the right order, my legislative House district is probably the least friendly Republican House district among the 44 members of our caucus.
Okay.
Meaning from a voter registration standpoint,
okay.
You look on paper, it's like, you shouldn't be here. You shouldn't be reelected to go down and represent Carroll County and Eastern Crawford County, because Republicans are such a small minority of the overall voter registration out of Carroll County.
So why do you think you've been successful running in that district?
You know, when I first decided to run, I looked at election history, and it's kind of like when you look at the health of a church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tell me what your membership number is, and then tell me what your attendance is Sunday morning, and I'll tell you which one is a real reflection of the health of that church. It's like, okay, so voter registration numbers are thus and such, but election history at state and federal levels indicate that quite often Carroll County voted Republican.
Okay.
Courthouse is all Democrat, but
sure.
And so I concluded, my impression back home is a lot of these folks are fairly conservative in both their social and their fiscal, you know, outlook on life. And so I thought, you know what, I think I could do this. Coming out of the city of Carroll, the largest community in the district, and being as well known as I was back home, I thought, you know, I think I could probably overcome that voter registration deficit, and I think at least the independent registered voters would support me.
Okay.
And my first election, in fact, I ran in 98 and actually lost my first race because I took on an incumbent. I didn't know any different.
Okay.
Three-term incumbent. Almost beat him.
Okay.
And I decided to come right back and run again. He decided to retire because it was too close for his comfort.
Yeah.
And so in 2000, it was a contested race, and I easily defeated the Democrat.
Okay.
And I guess the theory was proven correctly that having a conservative, even if that person was registered Republican, really, I think, truly reflected more of the values of the people in Carroll County than, you know, Democrats don't tend to be moderate to liberal back over in that area.
Sure.
They're pro-life, many of them, and certainly fiscally conservative.
Right? Okay.
And you put those qualities together, it's a very comfortable fit for people back home. Now, it isn't that once in a while some of that historic Democrat-leaning tendency manifests itself, as in last year's presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
President Obama carried Carroll County, and it's unique in that then candidate Obama, for some reason, concluded, I think I can win Carroll County, and if I can persuade Carroll County and carry Carroll County, I might be able to carry the entire state. And he did. He was probably in Carroll 5 times during his campaign and had a tremendous following out of Carroll County. So they
saw it as a bellwether county for Iowa.
Yeah, but then they keep reelecting me. And I haven't had an opponent in 4 election cycles.
Okay.
But I think, so you look at that, and then I think life experience, you know, for nearly 20 years I've been involved in a leadership role among the Christian churches, Churches of Christ in Iowa, overseeing new church development, being involved on a local congregational level with strategic planning and leadership development. And in doing that kind of work, you not only help others develop their leadership potential, but you refine and develop your own through that process. And then my colleagues in the Iowa House have elected me over and again to serve in the leadership team. And I'm the one they keep bringing back and have the most years of service in terms of a leadership role among the 44 House Republicans. So, you know, there are people who recognize leadership ability when, you know, you find a peer group of leaders saying you should come back.
I think that dovetails well into our next question here. Why should Iowa's Republicans nominate you over the others that are running in there now? 7?
Well, I don't know. Maybe as of today, there could be. You may know someone else that's in that I don't know. Actually, I've thought all along, and one of the reasons why my name was first mentioned even a year ago, again, going back to the registration makeup of my legislative district, that after the 06 and 08 general election cycles, the Republican Party is the party out of favor. Let's be right up front.
Sure.
And up until just recently, most people put a great deal of emphasis on the Republicans have a deficit of over 100,000 registrations to the Democrats statewide, so that's a significant registration hole. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the independents far outnumber Republicans or the Democrats as voting blocks. And how in the world are you going to be able to win an election when we're so far out of favor? And given the makeup of my House district, there were people who concluded, you know, for Republicans to be successful running against Governor Culver, we've got to have a nominee who can not only bring together the different disparate groups of the party's base, I mean, we've got them, you know, all over the board, but a candidate who can also appeal to at least the independent registered voters and, at minimum, conservative Democrats. You've demonstrated you could do that where you come from. And so that's, I think, partly why there were so many early on encouraged me to do that, because I think it's not just that my views align well back home, but I think leadership is identified in different categories. I mean, it's there are times you look at talents and skills, you know, and then beliefs and values. I think when people make a decision about a chief executive, when they think about choosing someone to serve as governor, it's going to be a combination of those things and temperament, personality. You look at most people who win the race for a chief executive office have certain qualities in terms of their temperament and personality and disposition that are appealing to people in terms of a leader. And so it's a combination of all those things. And a likable, friendly person quite often can win a contested race in a field where you may have someone with a long line of degrees and so forth and so on, or you know, experience in some particular area of a profession that looks on the surface that hands down that's a superior candidate. But when people are voting for a governor, there are factors that they look at, you know, that some things will weigh more importantly.
And certainly likability is one. Trust.
Yeah, absolutely. All those things. So it's more than just the obvious. There are a lot of these abstract values and qualities that the voters look at in an individual. That person looks like they could be governor. They sound like a governor. They're approachable, friendly. They look you in the eye, you know, and they shake your hand. It looks like he's interested in listening to what I have to say. And you enter a room and people naturally, oh, that nice person over there.
Okay.
Means something. So, yeah.
Hey, well, if you were to win the nomination and then go on and win the general election, what would be the Roberts administration's top agenda?
First of all, if you're elected governor, one of your first and primary tasks is to bring together people around you. Because it's just like we say in terms of being elected legislature, the most important vote you're going to cast is for your leader and your leaders. So as governor, the most important decisions you're going to make are those people you select and appoint to key positions of leadership in departments and agencies, the people you surround yourself with, advisors, staff, and key appointments to those positions. Move beyond that, and most people ask for I call it a vertical lineup of priority issues or topics. And for me, and I've said this consistently throughout this campaign, these are more horizontal for Rod Roberts, and it's obvious that the budget is something that we're going to have to, you know, there's no question that's job number one, is to get the fiscal house of the state of Iowa in order once again. I also think that making economic development a priority of both interest and time will be important for the person who's governor. As we come out of this recession, you're going to have to be chief advocate for why Iowa's a business-friendly place and why you should come to Iowa and start a business or invest in your company's future here in Iowa. And then I think I call it, just generally speaking, the fact that right now we seem to historically be at a place where citizens question whether or not their government understands the relationship between the people and the structures of government. Do you understand who's really in charge of government? Kind of a civics 101 thinking. Mm-hmm. That people want to have confidence in their government, but right now I think there's a question about people's confidence, trust, willingness to follow their leaders in government. I think the next governor has to be someone who can once again kind of restore trust and confidence. Sometimes in political lingo we talk about truth and transparency in government. I think it's far beyond that. I think it's back to a basic, can you rebuild trust with citizens toward their government? I don't know in what different ways that will manifest itself, but I really think those we elect to office next year and then probably for at least several cycles have to be very conscious of the importance of reestablishing this grassroots linkage with the structures of government so we kind of rebuild that trust once, because it's been lost. And there's a great deal of unrest with people. And I know that's a real different kind of category, but it's very real. And I don't care what your grandiose vision is for what program or what initiative you want to start, if the people aren't willing to give you their trust and confidence, I don't care what it is, they're not interested.
Absolutely.
So, you know, two things are pragmatic, the budget, the economy, and then it's this altruistic, you know, it's kind of rebuilding the basic blocks of, you know, good government again, and remembering that they're the ones in charge, not you.
I'm going to take a tech break for just a second, just to be sure. Okay. Governor Culver just last week announced a 10% across the board cut to the state budget due to a predicted budget shortfall. If you were to be elected governor, how would you approach spending cuts?
You know, first of all, when you ask me a question like that, I can't help but go back and say, this should have started a long time ago, because one thing that I've always stated fairly simply and directly back home and then practiced it in my years of serving in the legislature, and that is you've got to be careful in how you spend the people's money. This goes back to respect again to the taxpayers. And there's also a constitutional point that is important to me, and that is the legislative branch of government appropriates money. The governor is to manage the budget, and he has limitations on just what he can do with it. But when it comes to the problem that developed with our state's budget, this didn't happen overnight, and it wasn't a week ago or last Wednesday morning when we realized we had this significant a budget problem. We should have started a long time ago working with the legislature and saying we've got to abide by the 99% spending limitation, which I've always believed that's the law, which it is.
Mm-hmm.
Short of putting it in the Constitution, which maybe that's what we ought to do from now on, is seriously propose getting it passed, put in the Constitution, so then the people say you can't spend more than 99%. You should abide by that. We should have gone back and said, you know what, we're going to have to go and trim the budget, look for cost savings, as we did last session. House Republicans went through each budget, the work that the people of Iowa think we do every year.
Mm-hmm.
You actually go through the budgets and you go line by line and find areas where you can save money. That was done. $330 million were proposed in budget cuts. Working with the governor, I think the legislative branch, the executive branch, can find common ground on how you bring revenue and expenditures back into alignment. Now, having said that, if you got a mess like this that you have been responsible for, which it's kind of an apples and oranges thing, because
mm-hmm.
I'd like to think it would never have gotten that bad
mm-hmm.
with Rod Roberts as governor.
Sure.
But, you know, he actually, the governor did, at that moment in time, the only thing he could do probably from his vantage point, because he had denied all the way up until last Wednesday that we had a serious budget problem. And if you're in that kind of denial up until the last moment, and then you're all of a sudden confronted with a problem that large, he immediately ordered a large cut to the budget that, you know, was a significant reduction in what was planned for. And I think it's unfortunate for the people whose lives are going to be affected. And I'm not just talking about state employees, but when I think about the impact of local school districts,
mm-hmm.
that really caught people unawares, because even the best administrators anticipated maybe a 5% budget reduction. 10%?
That's huge.
Huge. I mean, that's poor management, let alone poor leadership on the mm-hmm. part of the governor. So it's kind of hard to be apples to oranges on that, because I would be proactive in anticipating. History tells you economies run in cycles. We knew that the revenue picture was deteriorating. We should have reined in our spending and been very cautious and prudent with spending, so we wouldn't be caught in a moment like this.
Instead of increasing it and taking federal stimulus money and
absolutely
it up,
and
so.
For all the bragging of, you know, we're spending, we made cuts to the budget, but you're spending more in the general fund than you ever have, and that's what people look at.
Which, yeah, you know, it seems like much of the spending cuts needed to be made that need to be made are within his spending increases.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How, you know, I'm a small mm-hmm. government conservative.
Yeah,
and how. Even though I think there are things that on the state level we should be doing that I don't think we have any business doing on the federal level, but mm-hmm. how would you as governor continue to shrink, at least manage the size of government and not allow it to grow into a, you know, largesse, bloated thing that we're facing at the moment?
Well, there are several ways to answer that. Number one, we go back to the 99% spending limitation.
Yeah.
That you abide by the law, that you only live within the revenue means provided, you know, by the taxpayers. You don't raise taxes on Iowans. That's the absolute wrong thing to do. Not only in hard times or difficult times, which mm-hmm. most people would say we're entering a very difficult economic time, but even when times are good, you don't need to raise taxes in good or bad times. We have adequate revenue resources in place that we should live within the law of only spend 99% of what you take in. That's just good common sense, thrifty Iowa, you know, financial thinking. That's one thing. Another thing, I think most people should be able to define what are the priority areas of government when it comes to spending the people's money. What should government do that no one else can do for the, you know, common good? And whether you answer that from a constitutional point of view, you know, life, liberty,
okay.
Pursuit of happiness, you know, the whole idea of personal property. But for me, it means that government exists to protect the law-abiding, peaceful, upright citizens, and you punish the wrongdoer. That's
okay.
a pretty just raw definition of government.
So definitely emergency services and director of Department of Corrections.
And that goes out of, that flows out of that. From there, so you might call that law enforcement corrections, that's right at the forefront.
Okay.
Access to justice, that kind of, that's another piece to that, separate but related to the first item. Then the third thing I would describe as commerce, which you might put infrastructure, roads, bridges, etc. The things that need to be in place for the common good when it comes to commerce, the economy.
Mm-hmm.
I think most people acknowledge that. And I think in Iowa, historically and even today, people are willing to invest resources in educating our young people. And I just mean kind of the wide definition of, you know, K-12 and higher education. You know, Iowans historically have said we invest resources there. And of course, with me, I've always been a strong proponent of making sure we advocate for parental choice when it comes to educating our children. So private schools are important to me, homeschooling. I've been supportive of all of those, even before I was ever elected to the legislature. Because the last thing you want is the government controlling education as a monopoly.
Should, what are your thoughts on the funding for preschool, the pre-K programs now?
I mean, I was opposed to a four-year-old preschool being rolled into the public system, not only from the standpoint of cost, but the fact of the matter is you already had services provided for young children privately and in other ways. We had enough on our hands trying to provide a five-year-old through, you know, 12th grade. And actually at the time, most school administrators would tell you, we don't need that too. And to, you know, the resources that you have are limited. Now you just expand the scope of what we have to deliver, and you're going to try to add more dollars, but those dollars might be better spent if you just, you know, put a five-year-old to traditional kindergarten through 12th grade.
So you have a Head Start program or something.
Yeah, so
like
I wasn't supportive of the four-year-old program to start with. But anyway, you're back to shrink the size of government. Someone asked me that not long ago. How would you shrink the size of the Department of Human Services? And I looked at the individual, I said, you do it through the budget, through money. I was like, well, that's no answer. So, well, if you've been in the legislature or in government as long as I have, the only time this is ever possible is when it's economic hard times, and you do it through the money. Because no one will ever be able to discover where you can do this when times are good.
Very true.
It's only in hard times. Now you're seeing it with what the governor ordered last week, 10%. They will be forced or compelled to downsize.
Well, even the I saw in the Sunday Register, they're suggesting the editorial board to drop from going from four mental health institutions to one.
Right. Yeah.
So never thought I'd hear the Register.
Well, no. It's different now.
Yeah,
it is. You know, it's different now. Post 9/11, when we had some economic hard times, and Governor Vilsack at the time decided to, you know, kind of go into this area of charter agencies, see if we could save money and do some streamlining. There was a twinge of economic downturn at that moment, but we rebounded nicely. All of a sudden, that's off the table. That's history. You know, only when you have a serious downturn and a true economic hardship time can you pull this off.
Okay.
Only at that time.
All right.
Because everyone will fight you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everyone will fight you.
What would you do as governor to help create private sector jobs?
I actually am a proponent that I think eventually what you do is eliminate the business corporate income tax in Iowa. I've been in the legislature long enough to see, you know, Vision Iowa, Values Fund, this program, that initiative, tax credit incentive programs, film industry, et cetera, et cetera. We've demonstrated that you definitely can affect economic activity by tax policy. You know, tax something less, you get more of it.
Absolutely.
And actually the net revenue to the state of Iowa through that particular category of income tax is only about $250 to $270 million, which, yeah, it sounds like a lot of money. However, in the big scheme of things, imagine what it would do both in terms of the dramatic statement it would make about Iowa. We're open for business. We're willing to demonstrate that by saying we're going to eliminate our business or corporate income tax here. We're serious about this. We want you to come here and invest in your future. Mm-hmm. I tend to think that that is the kind of message that does attract business. And the offset would be if businesses were to come to Iowa because of that incentive, you've eliminated their corporate income tax. The benefit is then you'll generate revenue through personal income tax and sales tax.
Very true.
Revenue. So the net might be much smaller than what you're giving up in that $270 million a year. You're getting it back with increased business activity, people employed. And I think ultimately, when you say that, that's how you answer the question of the 110,000 Iowans out of work. Mm-hmm. What do you do for those people? You do what you can to create private sector jobs.
It seems like California is finally starting to get that. They got a bipartisan proposal to eliminate corporate tax. Now it looks like they're going to have a better business environment than...
Well, the irony is it's not that unattainable for us. And I know with a difficult budget situation, you may, oh man, that's way out there. I don't think it should be for us. I think it should be a commitment, and I would make that as governor, that we're going to go down this path. And I know you might take some barbs to start with. Oh, you're just looking at corporate welfare here. No, I'm thinking about the 110,000 Iowans who are out of work.
Yeah.
They need jobs. Exactly. We're not going to make them for them. Private businesses will. And how do we get them to come to Iowa? This is what we do. And I'd make a hard pitch for that is in our long-term best interest and the best interest of these Iowans. Maybe it's not government's best interest to start with, but it is in terms of those families where they're looking for someone to create a job for them.
Absolutely. Kind of bonus question I just thought of. Your position on the federal deductibility.
We keep that. Okay. We keep federal deductibility. Absolutely. They have absolutely destroyed any hope of ever saying, well, all right, you know, you might consider if you eliminated that, it'd be a revenue neutral proposition and lowering our rates. And even then, maybe you have to do a supermajority to try and raise, you know, income tax rates after that. But now forget it. Nobody who's been around and watched this will ever touch it again because the public reaction will be they're trying to raise our taxes somewhere.
Absolutely.
That's permanently maimed.
Okay. Shift gears a little bit from kind of from fiscal to more of a social positions here. One of the priorities for social conservatives is to see the recent Iowa Supreme Court ruling on gay marriage addressed. How would your administration do that? I've heard a variety of different opinions out there from the candidates. I'd just like to know what your position is.
Of course, I was one of the first Republicans to rise and call for the immediate consideration of the resolution that we'd drawn up on the House side in anticipation that the court might rule as they did on April 3rd and said we should immediately take this up so that the question can eventually get before the people and they can vote on a proposed amendment to the state constitution. I still believe that's something the people are entitled to, and the proper response for us in the General Assembly is to take it up, pass it, let the people make this decision. Because ultimately, the question about marriage is a question that should be decided by the people for government, not the government deciding it for the people of Iowa. And that's a basic fundamental premise that I have on this whole matter. Having said that, I would also say that really the first people who have the opportunity to say something to the court about this are the people themselves, because the ballot in November of 2010 will not only be a method of electing people to represent us in office, the ballot is also a method of holding people accountable. And three of the seven justices appear on the ballot, and I've not been afraid or ashamed to say to people, remember, their names appear on the ballot under the question of retention, because it's our way of saying, justices, you are accountable to the people of Iowa for your service. They will decide whether or not you continue to serve on our highest court. So it could well be that next year Iowans tell one or more, maybe all three of the justices who are up for retention, we don't approve of your service on our Supreme Court, and we're going to deny you retention. We're going to replace you with new justices. I talk about that openly on the campaign trail. Because again, I see part of my responsibility is to make sure that people know how we are accountable to them, because it's their government.
Absolutely.
And so I think that's significant. The other thing I would say with regard to the question of the constitutional amendment, this next legislative session, I would like to see that resolution taken up and passed. But if it's not, I've been in the legislature long enough to know that before the legislature adjourns in the spring, they have to negotiate with the governor. And the governor has his agenda that he usually lays out in his condition of the state address in January. And you pick up out of that address, and then as you work through session, what his priorities are. Top one, two, whatever they are. Governor Vilsack was very good at negotiating with the legislature. He could get his top one, two, maybe three things off his agenda. Governor Culver last year was lucky to get one thing, and that was all his bonding stuff. That was the wee hours of the last day before he got that pulled together.
And it's his own party controls the General Assembly.
Shows you how weak he is to negotiate with his own party in the legislature. As governor, we're not only going to make a priority of getting our fiscal house in order, that's one of my agenda items, we're not only going to make sure that we do what we can to position Iowa to come out of the recession and send the signal we're business friendly, but we are going to take up that resolution. And if anyone says, oh no we aren't, I said, fine, then we'll just sit here for a while.
Okay.
We don't have a deal until you take that up. And you know what? I don't care how you vote on it, but you're going to take it up.
At least put your vote on record.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's all I'm asking. I'm not saying you have to pass it. I'm saying take it up and vote. Let the people know. Then I think we should also look at maybe how we select our justices. As governor, I think that might be fair to say, just what method do we use here to evaluate and review candidates? Where do they come from, et cetera, et cetera? That's another thing I'd be willing to look at. And you know, the next governor, if the people of Iowa tell one, two, or possibly all three of our current justices, you're not on our court anymore,
mm-hmm.
we'll then begin to remake the court with new appointees. So,
okay.
Anyway.
All right, sounds good. How would you, as governor, advance the pro-life agenda? A lot of you know, politicians say I'm pro-life, and you know, as a pro-life activist, sometimes don't see much action. I see a lot of talk.
You don't now. Of course, I was one of the on the House side. I was present when we first passed we use different descriptions for it. The ban on human cloning law. Representative Dan Boddicker floor managed that, and I helped him on the House side. And then I also fought the repeal. When Governor Culver was elected and the Democrats took control of the legislature, one of their first actions was to repeal our ban on human cloning. And so I fought against that, but obviously they then had the numbers, and that was one of their issues. And so I've already demonstrated in concrete ways that I'm committed to the idea that life begins at conception. When I say that I'm pro-life, I always like to take the time to also add language that says what that means is I believe it's important to defend the life of the unborn. That's what pro-life means to me, that there is a vested interest on the part of government to protect the life of unborn children. And I've tried to demonstrate that through my years of service in the legislature. Those would be two good illustrations of it. I was there to help lead the charge on putting the ban on human cloning in place. I was there to try and fight the repeal of that ban. And anytime there's been an opportunity to express that sentiment or will, I've always been more than willing, you know, to put my name on the line to say I will help try and defend the life of the unborn. And so that's why today, if you were to ask, for instance, Kim Lehman,
mm-hmm.
is Rod Roberts a strong, consistent supporter of life? I know what she'd tell you.
Okay.
Oh, yes, he is. Yep, he'd be right at the top of the list. And you know, depending on who's in the legislature, what happens at the federal level with our court, you know, Roe versus Wade, for instance, if it ever came to where we could pass our own state law, I would certainly do all I could to support legislation that would protect the life of the unborn.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. fine. We touched on it a little bit earlier when you were talking about small government. What is your stance on parental rights and education in K, school choice? How would you be willing to, what would you be willing to do as governor to champion the cause of parental choice, you know, private education, home education?
Of course, fortunately for me, I'm able to actually point to a moment in time in my first term as a state representative, then Governor Vilsack proposed virtually eliminating funding for non-public school transportation. And that's an item that comes close to home where I'm from, because the state representative out of Carroll County back in the mid-70s and folks from Carroll County were instrumental in helping pass legislation that provided funding for non-public school transportation that's funneled through the public schools where the non-public schools exist. And so we led the charge, and actually Governor Vilsack backed down and did not eliminate funding for non-public school transportation. Since then, I've been a strong proponent. When we were in the majority, I made sure that whatever the allowable growth figure for public schools were each year, 3%, 4%, that we also increased funding for non-public school transportation, non-public school textbooks at the same percentage. And we did that every year. And our appropriations chair could always count on me to make the point that whatever we're doing for allowable growth, we're going to do for those two line items for the non-public schools, and we did every year. I was also instrumental in working with then Representative Carmen Bull from Ankeny to help pass what we call the Opportunity Scholarship, the tax credit program, several years ago. We passed it. There wasn't any money to start with, but now it's gone up, you know, to where there was $7.5 million and $10 million proposed to go to non-public schools as tax credits where people could donate to a foundation and get a tax write-off for a portion of that, and in return those scholarship dollars were used for lower income families to be able to send their children to non-public schools. Good program, modeled after what Arizona had done. So I'm behind on that one too, you know, and have demonstrated that. So
Would you be open to just in general school vouchers or tax credits for, you know, any Iowan that would want to remove their child from, either want to do private education or something my wife and I homeschool. And
tax credits for...
And it's like, yeah, we can't even
no,
deduct
I'd be,
our books and,
yeah,
you know,
no, I'd
materials.
Be very open to tax credits for people who homeschool, you know, for actual costs, textbooks and that. Absolutely. Because again, fundamentally, I believe that the government should not have a monopoly on educating our children. And I served on the public school board for 5 years back home. But maybe because you're from Carroll and there's a strong dual, you know, competitive relationship between the public school system and the non-public Kemper, I could see firsthand the benefit to our community and how that friendly competition made both schools better.
Okay.
So I learned that firsthand. You want competition when it comes to delivering education. So if I can support non-public schools, if I can support homeschooling, I will do that. Because it's in the best interest of not only children, but I think communities, the state at large. We get a better outcome in educating our kids when there's competition.
All right. Last question here that I have, and I work with juvenile offenders, and I'm concerned about recidivism with those kids as they reenter the community later on becoming adult offenders. Iowa's prisoner population is growing. How would you as governor address this?
Well, here's a core belief that I have, and that is in terms of the institutions, the correctional institutions, we talk about Fort Madison, you know, Anamosa, Rockwell City, those places should be for violent, dangerous people. That's kind of another one of those cornerstone philosophical points with me, that when it comes to a better use of the taxpayers' dollar and the proper response to that kind of behavior, those institutions are designed to place dangerous people who should be punished and kept away from the public. I think a whole lot of other areas should be open to a willingness, community-based corrections, places that, not just in terms of a better economic decision on the part of government, which I think should drive a lot of this, because it's very expensive just to put everyone in a place, you know, like Anamosa or Fort Madison. I think there are people who may be involved in nonviolent crimes that are better served, maybe their families are better served, if we have a different response to their crime than just putting them away in an institution and thinking that they're, we did the right thing by locking you up. And again, from the taxpayer's point of view, I don't know if the taxpayers are getting the best benefit by just locking people up, because
sometimes that becomes felony university.
Yeah, well, and you get to the point where we don't have enough brick and mortar. Guess we better build some more, and then we better staff it, and then we, and it's like, this is not the right way to go about this. And
it just brought to mind, you know, IFI,
mm-hmm.
Interchange Freedom Initiative,
mm-hmm.
recently closed because Culver cut funding, even though
mm-hmm.
Sixth Circuit Court.
Sixth or okay.
The one down in St. Louis.
Eighth. This is the eighth.
More or less overturned the earlier decision,
mm-hmm.
Allowing funding with some stipulations,
mm-hmm.
but Culver decided, nah, not
yeah.
worth it.
Right.
And so therefore that program no longer exists. What would you do as governor to, I think there's obviously a lot of benefit and a lot of
mm-hmm.
Research has gone into the faith, public.
Yeah,
partnership when it comes to corrections and aftercare.
Mm-hmm. And I think that had demonstrated, you know, when you talk about recidivism, you know, and the results of that compared to what we do otherwise, showed to me that there was a benefit, you know, to the taxpayers by using a program like that.
Well, would you invite IFI back?
I'd have that debate, and I'd have that, yeah. I'd be willing to have that discussion and debate, and would be supportive myself and make the case for it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just want to give you a chance if there's anything else you'd like to share with those that listen or read as I write up the transcript.
Well, you know, I grew up here in Iowa, and my dad was a high school government history teacher, so I've always kind of remarked that my interest in public service and in government comes very naturally in a home where my folks kind of instilled within their children, I'm the oldest of five kids, that public service is a noble thing. It's good to contribute to one's community. And I know we're talking a much larger context here,
mm-hmm.
but it's the same principle that no matter who you are and what you do vocationally or professionally, there's this element of we all contribute to, you know, making the community, a state, a better place. We do it by giving of ourselves. And to me, that's kind of in the true expression of citizenship, you know, and of wanting to share one's talents and abilities and serving others, to be unselfish with it. And so I've tried to practice that through my adult life. You know, I've lived in Carroll for 25 years, and that's a great community to live in and a great place where people are encouraged to step up, get involved, use their talents and abilities, and certainly I've done that over the years. My wife has as well, and our children learn that. And that's kind of a neat thing when you see that passed on to your children, that it's a good thing to give back to one's community and to help other people in addition to what you do in your personal life, your profession, your church home. All these things, you know, are important. And so the opportunities I've had to serve, whether it be on the Carroll Community School Board or now in the Iowa House of Representatives, each one of those experiences prepares you for whatever chapter comes next. And I've taken to heart, you know, that people from different walks of life, different areas of the state, encourage me to step up and look seriously at running for governor. And it's been a great, I announced on July 21st that I'd created the Exploratory Committee, and I've been working hard ever since.
Mm-hmm.
I've traveled a lot, had a lot of opportunities to speak to Iowans, and the response has been very favorable as we have conversations like this.
Mm-hmm.
And people are hungry for capable and effective leadership. I mean, that's, it always comes down to, you can have a lot of good ideas, but we need people who can lead, who understand what leadership is. And no one knows what the future holds or what circumstances may come next. But if you have people who understand what leadership is, have demonstrated leadership, have the right approach to leading, and can bring good people around that also know what good leadership's all about, then whatever comes, good opportunities or challenges, you know, you're equipped and able to hopefully make good decisions and provide good leadership for the people of Iowa. And I think I possess those skills in terms of my background and the way that I'm wired, as they say, and would consider it a great honor to serve people as their next governor. That's the kind of language I use. It's not so much that, you know, I guess it's always healthy to have a dose of humility
mm-hmm.
when you're in public service. And I don't care where you're at in terms of the level of servant leadership. Always remember who it is who's in charge and who it is you work for. And always remember that what you have been given is a trust, and you do to the very best of your ability to serve those who have given you that honor and opportunity, and never forget that they're the people who are in charge, and do a good job for them.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I thank you so much
yeah.
for your time.
Thank
appreciate
you, Shane.
It.
Yeah. Very good.